I don't know how you dignify an introduction like that, so I guess I better ignore it. I've never told this on Jim, but I'm going to. I know most of you love him as much as I do. As he said, about 2.5 years ago, he became a member of the church that I am fortunate enough to serve in Huntsville. And typical of Jim Hires, he went into that situation the same way he does everything else with everything he has. And our church doesn't believe in this business of trying to, you know, slip around and encourage people to do things in the life of the church, you know, dream up things. We sort of play it straight. We have one organization in our church called a vestry. Those of you who are Episcopalians know what that means. This is the organization that is the most important organization in the life of our church because they're concerned with the control and the action of the life of our church. They do what I want them to do, that is. And a year ago, this is rare for somebody to be in the church such a short time. A year ago, the people in our church elected Jim to his vestry. And I'll never forget, excuse me, I'll be all right in a minute. That night, they said, this is what we think of you, Jim Hires. And that night he came up after the meeting was over and his big crocodile tears rolling down his face. And he said, you know, this is something that I never thought I'd see happen. That I could fool people badly enough for them to want me to serve them in the way they've asked me to do it. But that's the kind of guy he is. My name is Ed Kay. It used to bother me to say that I was not an alcoholic because I felt, well, people, well, you know, this guy's sort of bragging a little bit. But the realization, of course, it comes to me that I got so doggone many things wrong with me that to say I'm not an alcoholic really doesn't mean very much to me, because I've got an awful lot of other things going for me, against me. So I don't mind saying this anymore with qualifications. You know, each time I'm in preparing to come here for this weekend and realizing that I'll have the privilege of speaking to this group on Sunday morning, it fills me with a real sense of fear and trembling. And I don't scare very easily, but this always gives me a feeling of fear. And I finally think I've analyzed why. As I'm a professional speaker. Most of you, of course, are not. But this is what I do for a living. And now I think I've analyzed this and found out a little bit why. There's a certain finality to this situation. Now back home, I know there are many Sundays and many occasions when I bust one. You know, I don't realize it at the time, but it comes out and I have laid a great big fat egg and said nothing. And it doesn't give me a tremendous amount of concern because I know that next week or sometime a little later I can pick up the pieces, you know, I can rectify the situation. But not so here. This is a sort of a one-shot type thing. There's a finality to this because this is the only time that this group will ever be together as we are here. And I guess this is why I want so desperately to be able to say something of consequence. Feeling of frustration, I suppose, and anxiety. I heard not long ago, I like stories that exemplify the end, you know, the epitome of something. I heard about this story, about this young fellow who, about 10 or 11 years old, who stuttered very badly. on some things. Now, once in a while, he could get along real well, but he stuttered on things that he was emotionally involved in, which is typical of a stutterer. And he loved, beyond the ability of most of us to understand, banana splits, of all things. And he used to go down daily and get himself a banana split at the local ice cream store. And banana split was the thing he had trouble with. And he would go in and he would sit out at the counter and the waitress would say, "What do you want?" And he'd say, and it took him 15 minutes to come out with banana split. And every day he'd come home from school and his mother would give him a quarter and he'd go down to the store and climb up on the stool and start. "What do you want?" And 15 minutes later, he'd come up with banana split. So one day he figured out, "I can solve this problem. It takes me just about 15 minutes to get from my home to the ice cream store. So I'll start when I leave home." And this is going to work. And so he started out that afternoon when he left home with walking down the street. And he got to the ice cream store, and he walked in, and he crawled up on the stool, and the waitress says, "What do you have?" And he said, "Banana split." And she says, "What'd you say?" And he said, "Bubba, bubba, bubba." This is sort of the epitome of frustration. Incidentally, I heard just the other day another thing I think that exemplifies what might be called the epitome of frustration. I heard a tape of Colonel John Glenn talking to a group of space scientists in New Orleans, and he was talking about relative motion. Those things, how things in motion, in relation to each other, how the motion has to correspond and so forth, and how out in space you have to take account of this, and when you're in the capsule and one thing and another. And he told this little aside, this little story that was real descriptive of relative motion and perhaps frustration too. Talk about this guy who had this powerful sports car and had an obsession to drive real fast. He loved to ride real fast. He had this big, powerful, deep breathing thing. But it still wouldn't, it would only do about 100, and this wasn't fast enough for him, and he would love to drive 200-300 miles an hour. So somebody suggested to him, and was willing to help him with putting a ramjet engine in this thing. And he would have to get it up to about 90 miles an hour before, of course, this thing would cut in. But when it cut in, you know, just instantaneously, it would accelerate on up to 150, 200 miles an hour almost immediately. So he did this thing, and boy, this was great. He got it all ready and ready to try it out, and he knew this stretch of road was about 10 miles long, straight, and he could try it there. So he went out in his car, and he was wheeling along. He got it up to about 75, 80, and he passed by this little side road, and here is this cop on his motorcycle, and whoom, after him he takes. And of course, he didn't see him. He's intent on this thing. And he got up to about 85, just about 90, and he switched on his jet engine, and whoom, he took off, just instantly, worked perfectly. Got on up to about 200 miles an hour real fast, went on down the road, finished his run, got it slowed down, stopped, turned around, real pleased, was driving back. And he came up on this motorcycle, piled up on the side of the road, just completely demolished. And over a little farther was this motorcycle cop laying there, clothes all ripped off of him, bloody, just a mess. And he stopped his car and jumped out and ran over it. The guy was getting up and staggering around and really beside himself. And he said, "What's the matter? What's the matter? What in the world happened to you?" And the cop says, "I don't know. I was chasing this guy in a sports car, and we were just about to catch him, and we were doing about 85, and all of a sudden my motorcycle stopped, and I got off to find out why." You gotta be careful with this relative motion. I am never really sure what to say I don't have a story to tell as has been so graphically and dramatically and magnificently told by all of our previous speakers, and as all of you are able to do, and I complain bitterly about this to these guys, but they say that doesn't make any difference. So I never know really what to say. The only thing I try to do, I suppose, is to be an instrument through which God can speak to you. And I am always aware that God probably is closer to some of you than he is to me. And I ask myself, who am I? Who do you think you are to stand up here and talk to people who probably know a great deal more? Some of them know a great deal more about this than you do. And again, and I talk to myself a lot, you know, as you can figure out. And I do the thing that they say you're not supposed to do. I answer myself, too. That's when they say you're in trouble. But I have come up with an answer that I think has meaning for me to who are you? And the answer is, well, who does one have to be? Really, who does one have to be? It's not me that I am asking you to accept anyway, although you would accept me, you do accept me, and I know you would, and I know you will. But it's really not me that I'm asking you to accept. I know that no matter what I say, it will have some meaning for somebody if I can just get myself out of the way. I think that what I say, whatever I say, will be most helpful if, when you go away from here, you do not remember who said it. This is when I think that I can be the most helpful, and this is what I would try to do. Just be an echo. I talk to a great many people from time to time who, in one way or another, are having their troubles. Some of them who are alcoholics, some are other things. People who are in trouble, people who are disturbed, upset about several things, and sometimes I ask them, in fact, lately I've intentionally and consistently asked them the question, what is it that you think would solve all of your problems? What is it that you would like to have? And although the answers vary with the people, I have found that running like a thread through all of the answers that people give to what is it that I want most in life is the theme. Well, I guess I want happiness. I guess this is what I want more than anything else. I want happiness. And I usually ask them, what do you think happiness is? What is happiness? And again, the answers vary, but there seems to be a consistency, and someplace or other in the context of the answer to this question, people always give the impression that they think happiness consists in somehow or other the possession of certain things. Now, this has been my experience over and over again. Maybe some of you have had the same kind of experience. It seems that one of the major concerns of people is in finding happiness. Like, we use this expression like it's lost and we got to find it. And they dream of this thing, they plan for this thing, they save for this thing, they contrive, they do everything to find this happiness. People seem enveloped in a never-ending search. And interestingly enough, the search itself is as varied as the people who do the searching. In the quest for happiness, one man goes off to a far country and digs in the ground. Another man stays at home and plants roses, paints pictures, or writes books, both looking for the same thing. One man, in the search for happiness, buys a dozen homes. Another goes into the wilderness and becomes a recluse, both searching for the same thing in his own way. But always, in the midst of this search, satisfied or unsatisfied, men have the conviction that somewhere, somehow, there are things which will bring a way of living that will make them happy. And always it seems to be something outside themselves. If I could only find this thing outside myself. Not long ago, I read a publisher's advertisement describing a new book written about plastic surgery. One of these things crossed my desk, and the headline in the ad caught my eye. It said, "Unhappiness is only skin deep." And the realization came that this is the way people seem to feel about this thing. Unhappiness is only skin deep. That judgment on the external character of happiness, it seems to be one of the major points of reference from which our generation sets out to pursue happiness. It's only skin deep, someplace outside there. Happiness is sought by the average person in external ways. All around us, our society promises us happiness through external means. Part of the procedure is to promise us that if we will purchase a certain device or a certain product, a physical product, a thing, then this will in turn create in us a spiritual development. It'll enhance our spiritual lives. We'll get change in our character, a change in the quality of our lives. And thus, the girls are told that if they will use this particular deodorant, your problems are over, you know. If you'll shampoo your hair with this particular shampoo, then men will flock at your feet, and this is the end of your unhappiness. And all of these things, men, if you use this particular kind of aftershave lotion, and we smile at this, and yet we know it's true. And we know that we get figuratively sucked into this, into believing somewhere in our heads that maybe happiness is concerned with these external things, and maybe I ought to do some of the things I do. But we know this is nonsense. In our heart of hearts, we know it's nonsense. But sometimes we allow ourselves to be lured into discontent and unhappiness by following some of these leads. The fact is, and we know this, external things are not going to bring us happiness. There are two things I think that need always to be constantly remembered in this regard. The first is that if we could satisfy all of our desires, every last one, and if we could have everything on which we set our hearts, still, this would be no guarantee that happiness would be ours. A young fellow who went out to visit his favorite aunt in the country, spend a week with her. The night before the evening of that day, she said to him, "Bob, what is it you would like to have for breakfast? Now, this is going to be your time, and we'll start with breakfast in the morning. Anything you want is yours." And he said, "You know, I have never had enough pancakes. Mother always says that three is enough for any boy, but I've never really had all the pancakes I could eat." She said, "All right, your wish is my command." So the next morning at breakfast, here they came, stack after stack of pancakes, and he ate and he ate and he ate, and his aunt was relishing in this and fixing more, and finally she brought in a big stack, and Bob had stopped. And she said, "Well, what's the matter, Bob? There's still many more to go here. Don't you want any more pancakes?" And he said, "No, ma'am, I don't even want the ones I've already had." The sheer accumulation of things, no matter how good they may be, does not bring happiness. It's no guarantee of happiness. The second thing I think we need to keep in mind is this. A person's concentration on happiness can be self-defeating. I think the only thing probably that a person can concentrate on and accomplish really is getting drunk. Now, you can concentrate on getting drunk and accomplish your purpose. But beyond that, I don't know of many things that you can really tenaciously and without anything being anything distracting you concentrate on and really accomplish it. Years ago, someone put this truth into words, and I think are very relevant. The moment you allow your happiness to become the supreme object of your endeavor, inevitably you begin to play safe. And before long, you're playing entirely too safe to be happy. You stop working at the point where work ceases to be an easily purchased pleasure, and so deprive yourself of the joy that comes from hard work. You stop giving at the point where you can give without feeling it, and so deprive yourself of the joy that comes from giving that has reached the point of sacrifice. And you can even stop loving when it begins to hurt, and so miss the supreme joy of love that suffers long and is kind. The pursuit of happiness is always an unhappy pursuit, because it brings forth in the pursuer a self-concern. It defeats its own purpose. In our over-anxiety to be happy, we stop at the very point where we have our first chance to really be happy. If we are honest, and most of us here are honest, else we wouldn't be here, many of us will have to admit that we have never really opened the doors of our lives wide enough to let in anything other than that which is for ourselves. To let in anything other than that which ministers to our desires, our demands. Under such circumstances, we say we love one another. But what this really means most of the time is that we love what that person can do for us. Our children must cater to our desires. They must enhance our self-esteem. We want our children to do well so that it will reflect glory on us. A husband or a wife or other members of our society in which we operate must never cross us or differ with us because we blame them for destroying our happiness, when perhaps our happiness is only to be found in fulfilling their needs. Actually, happiness is a byproduct. I think most of us know this. Happiness is a byproduct. Comes into our possession when we have lost ourselves in a kind of living that is not self-centered. In reality, happiness is a byproduct of spiritual maturity. Big deal, he says, spiritual maturity. What is spiritual maturity? If it really is something, how can I get from where I am to where he's talking about when he says this? Well, like the professor said, who was ready with the answer, I'm glad you asked that question. We get to spiritual maturity by the step method. Now in AA, we have 12 steps to sobriety. Well, in the New Testament, there are set forth 7 steps to spiritual maturity. And even the steps themselves are called happy steps. We know these steps by another name. We call them the Beatitudes. And each step is just as important as the other, but just like the steps in AA, we have to begin with number 1. Let's take a little trip through these steps, briefly. Maybe you've never thought of them as steps, but this is what they are. One is based on the other in order. The first step says, happy are the poor in spirit. Now, spiritual maturity begins with the realization of spiritual poverty. And most of us at this stage of our lives are spiritually poor. And this is where spiritual maturity begins. Now, this has nothing to do with the possession of material things of life. What's being said here is, happy is the person who realizes that he is poor and stings in the spirit. It's not like saying, I realize that my life had become unmanageable. I was powerless over alcohol. When a person does this, when a person is able to admit this, recognizes this, then he begins to see his need for the grace of God. A little bit later, we'll talk about the grace of God. But when a person begins to see his need for this, then he's taken the first step. The second step says, happy are they that mourn. So like Ladd said last night, of what value is it to admit that one is powerless over alcohol if he doesn't do anything about it? We haven't done anything. So I like the difference between what people say when they come many times to me and they say, I need help. And I say, all right, you haven't told me anything yet. You say you need help, but do you want help? And they say, I don't understand what you mean. I just got to tell you I need help. I said, look, everybody needs help. And everybody knows he needs help. Do you want help? If you do, I can help you. If you're only telling me you need help, then let's have a cup of coffee and forget the whole thing. This is what I think is implied here. Admitting spiritual poverty and being sorry about it. One has to be sorry that this condition exists. It's only in this condition that a person can say, God, be merciful to me. You know, that's tough to say. It's tough to say. It rolls off my lips just like saying hello or good morning. And I know how desperately I need God's mercy and God's help. And I go around all day practically saying, God, be merciful to me. And in this be willing, a person needs to be willing to have the void that he knows is in his life filled in a way that only God can fill it. Having come thus far, the person's ready for the third step, and it says, happy are the meek. The person who realizes his spiritual poverty and mourns for his condition is then ready to be helped. He's ready to do what God requires of him. Now, contrary to popular belief, meekness does not mean weakness. Meekness is something that comes from It's a strength that comes from being truly humble. Now, I have a, reject this momentarily here. I have a conception of what the man Jesus was like that helps me tremendously. And they talk about Jesus being meek. Here was a man, about 6'4", weigh about 220 pounds, about the size of a Georgia Tech fullback, burned black by the sun because he worked always outdoors, tremendous muscles in his arms and in his chest and in his body, a man who had such strength of body and of spirit that both men and women could look into his eyes and be transformed on the spot. This man was meek. I can think of the time that the scripture tells us about when he went to Jerusalem, you know, and he went to the temple, and there he saw that the thing had corrupted itself, and there in the lobby or in the foyer of the temple were all of these people capitalizing on the fact that this was the center of the worship atmosphere of the whole city, and there is where they had their little games going. They had little lotteries going. They were selling sacrificial animals and birds and probably little pendants and little souvenirs for the suckers, you know, who came to Jerusalem and who would come and visit the temple, and they'd rake them over for this, and they'd go back home with this 25 denier gizmo they had paid 400 denier for or something like this. And our Lord came and saw this, and it made him sick at his stomach, probably, or practically. And he stood there in the door and watched this thing happening for a few minutes. And he probably picked up some strands of rope off of the floor that had been discarded. And as he stood there, he was plaiting these together like the girls used to plait their hair. And he stood there and he plaited this thing. And he as he watched, he got madder and madder and madder. And finally, he couldn't stand it any longer. And he wrapped that thing around his hand, and he started through there. One man. They didn't know who he was. One man. And he started through, and he knocked over tables. He knocked people down. He shattered bird cages. He kicked animals out of the way. And not a soul raised his hand to stop him. And you know why? Because they saw that fire in his eye, and they saw his sleeve drop away from his arm. And nobody wanted to tangle with this guy. They called him meek. Now, this is what meekness is. The strength that comes from real humility. From really knowing who we are. This is also the point at which this humility means so much to us. The point at which we can begin to hear people. You know, when we're so caught up in our own thoughts and in our own selves, it's difficult to hear what people say to us. And we're listening to them, we're listening to the words, waiting for the time when the words will finish so that we can take over and say what we want to say. Meekness is a very important part of this achieving spiritual maturity. The fourth step says, happy are they who do hunger and thirst after righteousness. Who do hunger and thirst. This is the point at which a person begins to realize that there is no happiness in things. The things of this world. He starts to understand that his only satisfaction is in having this void filled. And when he's hungry enough, when he wants it badly enough, then this void will be filled, we are told. Where before there is poverty, now there is the beginning of spiritual wealth. And as he takes this step, a person begins to get some insight into what the grace of God is, what it's all about. At this point, we're told, happy are the merciful. When a person begins to find this spiritual wealth, he's ready to start witnessing for it. You know, you can't keep anything if you don't give it away. He's willing to share this mercy so that he in turn may receive more. Now, this corresponds more closely with the 12th step in AA, and it's right in the middle of the steps to spiritual maturity. The next step says, happy are the pure in heart. Now this person is beginning to arrive. This term may be foreign, but this is probably the most closely the term that we understand the best, pure in heart. When we really think about it, we know what pure in heart means. One day, for 24 hours, I will stay sober. One objective, one goal. This is what being pure in heart means. Nothing else. To will one thing. Yet how easily distracted we are, how easily we come apart. The same person who, deep in the throes of his alcoholic insanity, can stay sober for 24 whole hours, that same person, a little later on, when he gets a little sobriety under his belt, can be knocked off his feet by any little thing that comes down the road. It's always struck me as rather ironic. And maybe if the alcoholic retained some of that same pureness of heart that got him sober in the first place and carried it over to the rest of his life, he wouldn't have nearly as much trouble as he has. And we talk a great deal about prayer in AA. I know that many people have difficulty with prayer. I must confess that I don't know a whole lot about prayer. I know that when I pray, coincidences happen. And when I don't pray, coincidences don't happen. That's about all I know about prayer. But I think that this has something to do with this pureness of heart. I remember Bishop Gordon, a bishop of Alaska, telling a story not long ago about a man, an Eskimo, name was Henry Sevick. And Henry had been in the church just a short time, very devout churchman, and he had been elected to be the lay delegate to the General Convention in Hawaii. And he was to go to Seattle, fly to Seattle, and there catch a plane. Someone was going to meet him there, and they were going to get on a plane and fly to Honolulu for the General Convention. And they put him on the plane in Anchorage. And when he got to Seattle, he landed at the airport, and as is the custom of most Episcopal clergymen, the guy who was supposed to meet him wasn't there. He got mixed up on the time of the arrival of the flight. So Henry got off of that airplane in a strange city. He'd never been there before. He had on his fur parka and his fur hat and his fur pants and his fur boots. Spoke almost no English, enough to be able to be understood, but that was about it. And what was he going to do? Well, someone got him on a limousine, on the limousine going into town, and he rode in, and they put him off at this big hotel downtown, right in the heart of the city, and Henry Sevick got out. This, in the true terminology, ignorant of the ways, the customs, Eskimo, dressed so ludicrously for the sophisticated people of Seattle, looking for Father Paul Lund, one Episcopal clergyman in that vast city, whom he had no idea what he looked like or who he was. What was he going to do? Well, he walked down the street, and I'm sure that people turned and looked at him and laughed at his peculiar getup. And finally, he decided if he's going to find this man, he's going to have to ask somebody. And so he stopped a man and asked him, "Do you know Father Lund?" And the man, looking at this weird-looking creature, said, "Of course not," and brushed him off and went on. And now he really didn't know what to do, but Henry had been taught that God answers prayers. Now, his life was not so complicated and sophisticated as ours. He had been taught that God answers prayers, and he knew how to pray. He prayed to God before, and God had answered his prayers before. So Henry walked to the middle of the sidewalk and knelt down there on this busy street, one of the main streets in Seattle, and he said, "God, you know I need help. I got to find Father Lund, and I don't know where to look. Help me." And he got up, and he walked two doors down, and he saw there an attractive display in a window, and it turned out to be a travel bureau. And he saw all these strange, exotic papers and so forth, and he decided he would go in there and talk to somebody. And he walked in and looked around, and standing at the desk was an Episcopal priest. He saw a man with a white collar on, a backward collar. And Henry, in his unsophistication and his pureness of heart, walked up to this man and said, "Are you Father Are you Father Lund?" "It was." Now, I don't know what you call that, but that's a true story. And I call it pureness of heart. It really happened. And this, I think, is maybe what prayer is. If we get our sophisticated selves out of the way and recognize that God answers prayers, maybe we get some insight into it. Now we come to the last step. It says, "Happy are the peacemakers." Hear the 12th step over again. It said once in the middle and again at the end. A person has reached a degree of spiritual maturity. Now he's beginning to get a real taste of what happiness is. He's become a peacemaker, and he's on fire with one purpose, and that's to share what he has with everybody he can. And in all of man's wisdom and cleverness, he has never been able to find a shortcut to spiritual maturity and its byproduct, happiness.
He seemed to need to learn the lesson over and over again that the important and meaningful things in life are still costly. They still cost a great deal. But finding spiritual maturity is the only way that you and I are ever going to find happiness. There's really no need to go off looking for it someplace, digging in the ground for it, or planning far to trying to get it by accumulating things. It'll come only as we continue to do the very things we have to do day after day, hour after hour, and at the same time, seeking to understand God and His will for our lives. When a person is taking the steps towards spiritual maturity, he is finding out also what God means and is. And he knows happiness at its best as a byproduct of this. And he's also being released from the prison that is himself. And he's no longer afraid and insecure.